And right now we welcome business commentator Rebecca Stevenson. Morena, how are you?
Morena. I'm good, thank you, Catherine. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Now, how outside investment is revving up motor racing, and could the same formula work for the All Blacks? More on the All Blacks in a moment, but first, what's happening with Formula One?
Well, I've been really enjoying watching Formula One this year, so I've enjoyed doing this wee deep dive, and it really took me back to a long time ago, actually. Well, 2014 feels like a very long time now, where we had the former Formula One Supremo Bernie Ecclestone sat down for a quite negative interview and proceeded to explain why, despite dwindling television audiences and waning interest, it just wasn't worth bothering trying to attract a younger audience to Formula One. And he also said that he personally couldn't see any value in social media. Bernie Ecclestone said, "I don't know why people want to get the so-called young generation. Why do they want to do that? Is it to sell something? Most of these kids haven't got any money." He said young people might want a Rolex but can't afford it. And for Formula One's other sponsors, like the banking giant UBS, the kids haven't got enough money to put in the bloody banks anyway. Ecclestone went on to say he would much rather target a 70-year-old guy who's got plenty of cash. And if marketers want to aim at a younger audience, they should advertise with Disney. Now, that was 2014, and we are in 2022 now, and things are quite different. We just recently had the inaugural Miami Grand Prix on May 9, which had bumper crowds and was brought to you by Crypto.com. And we've got Formula One experiencing its highest ever ratings in the coveted US market, with the 2021 season becoming the most viewed in US broadcast history and an average audience of about 940,000 viewers per race. The Miami race was a triumph for the sport in this market, where they've really struggled to capture people, but is now a clear focus for Formula One, with a new Las Vegas race set to join the calendar alongside the new Miami and Austin races, and interest in Formula One hitting astonishing highs. We saw the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix become the most viewed Formula One race on ESPN since that network acquired the rights in 2018, and that was the most viewed F1 event on US cable since 1995, with the race averaging more than 1.4 million viewers. And really interestingly, it really hit some of those key demographic groups that advertisers and marketers really like, including that all-important 18 to 34 age group. So what has changed for Formula One? New ownership, new audiences, new races, new rules to level the driving field, much more content, and plenty of memes. Liberty Media Group, which is owner of the Atlanta Braves Major League Baseball Club and the SiriusXM radio company, purchased Formula One in 2017 in a deal which put a multi-billion dollar price tag on the business through a mostly debt-funded deal. It purchased Formula One, which holds exclusive commercial rights to the FIA Formula One World Championship, which is a nine-month-long motor race competition in which teams compete for the Constructors' Championship and drivers compete for the Drivers' Championship. The history of Formula One goes back to 1950 and I think is well regarded as the world's most prestigious motor racing competition, and it has been incredibly popular over the years. Of course, we do have a New Zealand link there with McLaren Racing Team, who have been having a tough year, but of course they trace their history to famous West Auckland driver Bruce McLaren. Now, this has all been working out pretty well for Liberty. Liberty reported a US $2.19 billion revenue in its first financial quarter in 2022, which was a 6% increase year over year. And just the Formula One business pocketed US $360 million in revenue during that quarter, which was a really chunky increase on the revenue in the same period in the prior year, which was US $180 million. This quarter, F1 has also secured new sponsorship deals with software company Salesforce. You'll be seeing all over your screens if you've been watching Formula One lately, tech giant Lenovo, and also MSC Cruises. Liberty is just doing exactly what Bernie Ecclestone thought was a waste of time. In an interview with Forbes, the Formula One boss Stefano Domenicali said, "The availability of our content has got to meet the needs of the customer, and that customer that F1 is looking for is not that 70-year-old. Domenicali said the new generation wants to be connected to what they love at the time they want, and we need to understand that. The traditional way of promoting sports is no longer valid, or it's more valid in certain places and less valid in certain areas of the world. And that's something we need to bring home to make sure we're attractive. Otherwise, you lose opportunity, and we cannot allow that to happen. Formula One has really focused in on their customer. And yes, Bernie, absolutely Generation Z has been a focal point for Formula One. It's really prioritized content and connection. And a lot of that has come through the incredibly popular Netflix series Drive to Survive, which has helped to engage that bigger audience, regardless of where a race is, whether it's Singapore, Miami, or Melbourne. Since Drive to Survive, we've seen an absolute explosion in interest in Formula One on social media. Their social platforms were up 40%. The engagement and video views have risen 50% in 2021. And the American-based media company has also helped F1 land a three-year US media rights deal with ESPN. Since that debut on Netflix, though, they've just grown this audience so extraordinary. And one of the things that's been really cool about Drive to Survive is the way that it's showed us what's happened in Formula One and just given us such a great look behind the scenes. And one of the producers behind Drive to Survive has described the series like this. It has young, good-looking guys driving fast cars in amazing locations. Behind it all, you have powerful people and brands fighting it out. We used to joke in the early days that it was Game of Thrones in fast cars. And it has just been a juggernaut, just like Game of Thrones. We're seeing huge increases in young people, particularly that 18 to 24 demographic, talking about Formula One. And then also that next cohort of the 25 to 35-year-olds are also increasingly talking about Formula One online. And this has been pinned by media analytics companies as a really serious shift for Formula One. It also had its global fan survey, which saw a big increase in respondents and also a big increase in women responding to that survey. There's been more research done into these new US fans, and it's found out some interesting things about them. These new F1 fans in the US are three times more likely to use Medium or Reddit. They spend time on TikTok, SoundCloud, and YouTube. And Reddit in particular has a really thriving Formula One community, from the technical subreddits where they are endlessly debating the ins and outs of the car setups and the new rules. And then there are other subreddits, like a really interesting meme subreddit called Formula Dank, where the drivers are sort of face morphed onto strange videos and used in the sort of mocking meme culture. And we're also seeing, you know, the drivers and the teams themselves now being allowed to lean into social media too. And we've seen, you know, Lando Norris, who is a McLaren F1 driver, he's been breaking records on gaming streaming platforms, just streaming games, and people are really engaging him. So we know these new people are car enthusiasts, they are often gamers, and really helpfully for Formula One, the research is showing that they are highly motivated by brand names. So a really extraordinary, I think, story here about F1 has really turned it around and focused in on a newer, younger audience quite successfully.
Yes, that Netflix series is amazing, isn't it? And we've seen that happen, similar docos with basketball really have wide reach as well, but it seems to have been a launch pad more than just, you know, adding to the interest that people might already have in the sport. It seems to have been an absolute launch pad.
It's really extraordinary, you know, and you can just see it, you know. Drive to Survive is becoming a sort of a water cooler conversation now. And when the new series has come out, people are going back and re-watching the old series. And so you're getting the opportunity to learn a lot more about the people and the products. And that helps to drive things like brand loyalty, loyalty to the drivers. And of course, that all ends up being fantastic for Liberty Media, the owner of Formula One.
So what is the lesson here for other sports? Perhaps not, you know, it's hard to match, as you say, the fast cars and the age and the sort of the, you know, the various marketing attractions that you might see to these particular athletes. But what lessons are there for other sports about how you can't just get some cigarette sponsorship and some booze sponsorship and slapping around some, you know, rugby grounds and you're away? This is exactly what New Zealand Rugby's been talking about and wanting to try and land the Silver Lake deal. It's been talking about esports. It's been talking about breaking into large markets that are not followers of the rugby code. And does it sound like it is, if it does it well, on track?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, we know the New Zealand rugby members are going to be voting on this proposed investment, and that big driver and thrust, as you pointed out, of that Silver Lake deal is those hopes that that private equity money and Silver Lake itself is going to help New Zealand rugby tap into those new innovative products like esports, like virtual reality test matches, and I think also getting an outside eye to focus on the live match experience also that New Zealand rugby is providing. And we're probably also going to see the All Blacks, you know, playing elsewhere, you know, much like how Formula One has really tried to diversify into new markets and push into there. Auckland University of Technology sports marketing expert Marilyn Giroux was interviewed earlier this year, and I think she had some really good points about it, which was that while Silver Lake will look for opportunities to increase that profitability, it'll give an opportunity to bring up other brands as well outside of the All Blacks brand, you know, including looking at the women's national rugby team, the Black Ferns. You know, women's rugby, she said, is an untapped market. And, you know, the All Blacks also need to look at increase the range of merchandise they have on offer. You know, she also talked about that experience of watching live money needs to be improved too. And I think part of it that's crucial that Liberty Media has done and that Silver Lake needs to work with NZR is that loosening up around how the players can engage with social media and how fans can engage with the brands and the people is going to be a key thing going forward. You know, Formula One was famous for being very tightly controlled and stringent around using clips from its products, little video snippets, you know, very tight around the IP. The All Blacks have also been, you know, really rigid and quite tight around that, even around, you know, players commenting in interviews and things. So they're going to have to work around that and work out how they can keep that control they really do like to have around their branding, but then allowing that personality, flavor and interest to grow and be fed by the fans and also by the people inside that business as well.
The only worry I have about this is the flip side, which is the player welfare and the player exploitation. Mm. It's ironic, we were just having Sport New Zealand, High Performance Sport New Zealand on this morning about this issue of player welfare, and we know what has happened to athletes, to many top athletes, particularly women athletes, when exposed to social media toxicity online. And the second thing is, there's only one reason that a private equity company is in business, and that is to make money and improve profitability for itself. And I think this is where some of the reservations were initially with grassroots rugby, is that, okay, you can turn this into a commercial juggernaut, but where does that leave the players at all levels and the sport here in New Zealand? It's an interesting debate. It's one thing to do about Formula One, which was always a, you know, elite rich person sport, to Bernie Eccleston's point. It's quite another when you talk about your national sport, and I wonder whether that's where some of the reservations been, although actually those grassroots, you know, operators, many of them signed up.
Yeah, it is really interesting. And there is, I think, as you've, you know, really clearly identified, there's a tension there. And I think that tension is going to be really interesting because, look, I would love to see a behind the scenes, warts and all, look at the All Blacks. You know, I can't imagine that would happen even under this deal, just because it would feel like such a culture change and shock.
It's like walking into the Queen's bedroom. Just she herself is the one who says, you know, keep the mystery. Exactly.
Yeah, it's a really fine line and a fine balance. And the teams, I think, in Formula One help their drivers weigh that up. But inside of the Silver Lake deal is something that's really been useful for Liberty Media as well. And it's the fact that they can then use the other parts of their business to help out. So Liberty Media has stakes in some massive firms, you know, some of the most biggest tech companies in the world, you know, Twitter, Dell, Airbnb, Broadcom, Alibaba. So there's a big opportunity there for NZR through this deal to, you know, potentially get tech help, help them better at streaming their own content. You know, it's about joining up those little pieces that Liberty Media has and put them together and working out a plan so they can maximize what the All Blacks has, because, yep, they are absolutely focused on profits. But then in the background, NZR has also got its own, you know, agendas and lines that it won't want to cross.
Really interesting times. All right. And when are we finally getting a final vote? I thought we got the players over the line in the end, didn't we? The Players Association. Now there's still another hold up. Have we got a...
Yeah, that's in June.
Okay.
In June. June 2, I believe.
Which is very, very close now. Now, yep. Crypto investing, the end is nigh. We've heard that many times before. And others say, no, this is the only way we're going to be doing transactions in the future. So where are we sitting in its evolution? And what is the impact of this crazy volatility at the moment, a very disrupted global economy at the moment, on crypto?
Yeah, so look, I'm going to step a little bit away from crypto's recent fall because I think we've got our own NZ example about, you know, even when things actually, there are some safeguards in place, crypto is still very difficult if you are an investor. We had an update out recently from the liquidator of the failed New Zealand cryptocurrency exchange, Cryptopia. And I just think everybody should get on and read this because it should be a wake-up call for anyone who is thinking about investing in crypto, even without what we've had happening over the past week or so. The Cryptopia saga has really everything that you would expect to see in a crypto scandal and most of the things that financial regulators like to warn people about. It has theft, hacking, and high risk. You know, it was liquidated in 2019 and something like 900,000 Cryptopia account holders are yet to see an Elon Musk-favored Dogecoin back after it went bust. We've seen a Cryptopia employee admit that he stole from the firm after it was liquidated. And then, of course, there was this hack which was ultimately pushed the firm under and the shareholders of that company decided to liquidate it. Grant Thornton was appointed and it said in its most recent report that it was continuing to work with the New Zealand police and international authorities to find the source of the January 2019 hack. They have been working on tracing exercises to find those stolen funds. They have filed recovery actions in the US, Malaysia, and Singapore. And for the most part, the liquidators say the actions in relation to the hack have been focused on recovering information that sets out the movement of the crypto assets post-hack. So really, since this liquidation, we've just seen a blizzard of court actions proving that even when there are some protections for investors, you know, this firm was liquidated in New Zealand, it is incredibly difficult to trace assets and even proving the ownership when they're recovered and where they should go to is a whole nother thing. The liquidators have used disclosure orders against other crypto asset exchanges to follow and find that money. They're still trying to work out and get a detailed analysis of these hacked coins. Over the entire liquidation period since 2009, Grant Thornton has recovered cryptocurrency and converted it to more than $9 million of fiat currency, recovered another $5 million, and had total receipts of $17 million. But on the flip side, it has been really expensive to run this liquidation. There's about $14 million in billing there with more than $4 million on the liquidator's fees. Grant Thornton has had to take on this logistical challenge of unwinding the affairs of these estimated 2.2 million users from more than 180 countries holding digital assets that are famed for their pseudo-anonymity.
What a nightmare.
It is a nightmare. They've had to establish a portal for investors to register their details. There's a four-step process which should eventually culminate in getting some crypto back. But, I mean, even they say even when they get to the point where they're going to be handing out some cash, the courts will be involved. They say the courts will have to approve a distribution model. It'll have to confirm what will be done with the unclaimed crypto assets, and the court will have to set a cutoff date for claims to be received and assessed. It's spent hundreds of dollars on cybersecurity specialist staff. It's spent $10,000 on hosting data, I guess, in the cloud somewhere. And, you know, Grant Thornton has been really upfront since its first report that the absence of legal precedents on crypto assets in New Zealand and worldwide means the distribution of these assets and the overall conduct of the liquidation will require significant direction from the New Zealand courts. This is expensive, it's time consuming, and is very painful for Cryptopia users who haven't seen any of their coins back and are now really reduced to sarcastically commenting online that perhaps the liquidators should pay them out now because their assets are basically not worth much. So many issues with cryptocurrency. It's a nightmare.
Look, it is. And you do, you are left wondering about its future. And you're always looking around, aren't you, saying, you know, are you going to be the doomsayer or the doomsday, you know, warning to something that goes on and becomes the internet, you know, or Facebook? Or, in fact, is this an emperor with no clothes? And it's seldom one or the other. It's just, for so many people, it remains just so incredibly complicated. And for regulators and now for liquidators, you know, whose mission is to go through mazes and unravel, you know, all sorts of complicated setups, it just remains in the too hard basket, perhaps, for many people.
Yeah, it is really difficult. But, you know, it has been worrying me because, you know, over the last 2 years in particular, it's become really obvious to me how mainstream crypto has become. You know, I saw it on Formula One. We see it on the rugby league now. You know, I saw some women last year who are in multi-level marketing schemes jump to a crypto multi-level marketing scheme. And this is a real concern, I think, for regulators around the world, because as it grows and become more mainstream, you're going to have these sort of desperate and, you know, out-of-pocket investors. It starts to become very worrying. And I love this comment. I saw this fantastic interview with Nicholas Weaver from UC Berkeley, who's been studying crypto for a long time. And he summed it up to me, you know, he said, it is effectively a giant self-assembled Ponzi scheme. You hear about people making money in Bitcoin or cryptocurrency. They only make money because some other sucker lost more. And that's why we're seeing so much advertising for crypto now, because they need a constant flow of new people coming in to buy it. Or what does the cryptocurrency do? You know, Warren Buffett held Berkshire Hathaway's annual meeting recently and really sort of went in on crypto and said, you know, unlike other investments like, you know, farms or housing, you know, they are productive and they have a value when you own them. And he just said crypto just doesn't do that. You have to have someone else to sell it to. Unfortunately, the music is stopping now for some investors who are those last on and worst off.
Thank you very much, Rebecca Stevenson, business commentator.